The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm John McKenzie, but I'm not joined, as I always am, by my good pal and producer, Mike Zimmerman. But that does not mean to say that we don't have a really exciting episode planned for you guys today, because on the podcast today, we have Chris O'Hare, who is a youth coach at Villarreal. But he's not just a coach, he is also a qualified psychologist as well. And that's the topic that we talk about in today's episode, because I'm interested to hear from Chris what difference it makes being a qualified psychologist in terms of the coaching role itself. And so the episode is going to focus on this coach-psychologist hybrid role. And I think there's plenty of interesting things along the way. So as I always say, the best thing for us to do, I think, is just jump straight into that conversation. This is Chris O'Hare, who is a youth coach at Villarreal. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me, John. I will hopefully bring some value at some point.
No, I'm sure you will. Before we get to the value adding, let's talk a little bit about your background, because a lot of listeners won't know necessarily how you've arrived at the place that you've arrived at in your career. So let's start off with some basic background. So how did you end up in football coaching?
So I've always been obsessed with football ever since a young boy. And after coaching in many different parts of the world, so I lived in Korea, China, a little bit in Japan, I knew that I knew two things. I knew that I enjoyed working with people, and I knew that I loved football. And those are still the principal drivers of what make me get out of bed in the morning: people and football. So you'll usually see me on the pitch with a big smile, enjoying every moment. And I think that my love for the game has always been there throughout traveling all over the world, living in different cultures, and ultimately ending up here in Spain.
You mentioned the word cultures there, and obviously you've worked in a lot of different countries, and I guess it's easy for us when we spend most of our time in the UK to think that, you know, one size fits all when it comes to football, right? Everyone is trying to do the same thing when they're coaching, training teams. But obviously that cultural aspect is a really important aspect of how you can get teams to perform. So tell us a little bit about how the journey that you've had through those various cultures has changed your attitude to the way that football should be coached.
They have defined what I do on a day-to-day, minute-to-minute basis completely. Because by living in different cultures, you understand, obviously, the cultural elements, obviously, the way in which people perceive the world is very, very different. But then to get onto the tangible immediately, so people don't think that this is just throwing out words or key buzzwords such as culture, you understand the conceptual differences that arise from football. One of the lovely things that I love talking about in my first year here in Spain was the idea of crossing. So I don't know if you were, but in Spanish, the word cross is centro. But they don't have really a lexicon for different types of crossing. So they don't really have the whipped or the floated or the searching, which obviously is a completely different way of playing, because a searching ball, you would never really play it on the byline, because the likelihood is the centre-back's going to win that duel. So I think that those things and understanding concepts and cultures give me an incredible advantage of connecting with the players and ultimately coaching players.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. We will go on to talk a little bit more about those aspects, not simply the linguistic aspects that you've raised there, but also the psychological aspects. Just give us a little bit of an indication of how it was that you ended up in Spain, because I've just chatted to Simon Goody on this podcast as well, who's a coach who's working in Spain, who's moved there from the UK. Seems to be a lot of people who end up going from the UK into the Spanish context.
Well, I know Simon quite well, and he's a great guy, and we are very, very few, put it that way. I think that Simon and I know one other coach who's made it into the system. Of what I know, I'm the only full-time coach, and I think that's because the competition here in Spain is so high. The coaching level, even at amateur clubs, is so high. the coaches have very, very good minimal knowledge, shall we say, and the minimal standard in Spain is much higher than other clubs. Why on earth clubs from all around the world aren't scouting what we would say the Tercera F, which is the third division in Spain, and looking at those players very, very closely is beyond me. And I do know that there are some clubs in Europe who are going to venture into that. I've been told by their scouting departments. My journey is a little bit different in that I was living in Asia and I wanted to basically become a professional within football. I knew that my journey had already delivered a lot of value. However, I knew that if I went back to the UK, as Simon talked about previously in his very good podcast, it's very difficult to differentiate yourself. Even if I do have a psychological background, it's still very difficult to get onto those coaching badges and so on. I came here to Spain, and no word of a lie, I came here with zero Spanish. My Spanish teacher from school absolutely hated the disruptions in class every single moment. But I came here because of that challenge and because I knew that that was going to be difficult. Within the first year, I was hired by Castellón, CD Castellón, who are a club equivalent to Middlesbrough, one city club.
Paulo Hernandez, Leeds legend, was there, right?
Exactly.
He was.
And now they have a very good trajectory as well. They're really, really doing very good things there. And then after 3 years there, working with under-14s, won a couple of trophies, won a couple of different leagues and so on. I went to work with an amateur team to finish some of my other qualifications. Finished my qualifications, and at the time I was training a team which consisted of two Romanian kids, two Moroccan kids, a Venezuelan, a Colombian, an English kid, Spanish children. So it was this complete, it looked a bit like the United Nations. And the reason I could do that is because of my experience with different cultures. I was able to balance personalities very well. Cut a long story short, the team did very well, and one of my players got selected for the national selection, and my games got scouted, and as a result, eyes were placed on me, and then Villarreal came in and signed me. And then in the first year, I worked with the under-12 A team, which to listeners, that's not a big deal, but here in Spain, it's a really big deal because it's a symbol of your entire academy's projection, and they take it very, very seriously, and they do an incredible job. We reached the semi-final against Madrid, in which Madrid played long ball football to two lads who had a biological age of 17 and 18. They were huge. They scored from a throw-in. A header, goal, and that was the goal that decided the match. And the reason they did that is because we created a team that could work in all four phases of the game, and then psychologically were incredibly strong and able to apply those things within the game. And then from there, now I'm working with the under-17s and under-19 team.
You've mentioned the word psychology and psychological a few times there. You have a background in psychology as well. So how does that story of your psychological upbringing weave into the story about football?
So I went to university, studied psychology at university, and I always knew that, like I said, one of my main obsessions was people. How do people work? Why do they do the things they do? How can we, in a good sense, get people to where they need to be to get to peak performance? Because that's an incredibly important thing in life, including myself. I'm just like anyone else. I suffer from a little bit of doing the wrong thing when I should be doing something else. I end up getting distracted quite easily. So I'm not saying that I'm different to anyone, but I also wanted to understand other people. And then throughout my journey, when I was studying my psychology degree, when I was doing my master's, I have a master's in elite coaching and a master's in elite sports psychology. I always saw the two things as completely linked. I always saw the two things as being one of the same. because yes, said club goes out and spends 80 million on, let's say, X winger. We'll call this winger X. X is technically fantastic. However, if mentally you cannot get this person to perform in the style of play that you want to, you have threw 80 million euros, pounds in the wind. And I think we see that happen again and again and again, especially the five most recent signings. I think only two of them we can say are the most expensive. Two of them we can say are the have done well, and the other three are, as we saw at the weekend with Chelsea versus Liverpool, still settling in for a lot of money, settling in, may I add.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. And we're going to start talking a little bit about how you implement the psychological ideas within your own football coaching. So you are essentially a football coach / psychologist, almost a hybrid role.
Yes.
And it's, I think it's very unusual. I've never really heard of anything like that before, which is why I thought it would be great to chat to you today. But let's start off just by clarifying a few things, because as I say, you describe yourself as a football coach / sports psychologist. I guess there may be listeners out there thinking, well, you know, haven't football coaches always had that psychological aspect built in, baked into their game? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that, because presumably you think that, yes, that's true. And the coaches who are really great are the coaches who are able to implement some of these psychological ideas in their game. But presumably there are a lot of people out there as well who don't make the most of the skills that you can learn as a psychologist, as a coach, to then be able to get the most out of players.
Yeah, 100%. So I've just been watching a small section of a podcast. I like to listen to ex-professionals quite a lot. And the reason I like to listen to them is because I think that you glean things from their perspective. And what they were talking about is how Jurgen Klopp formed a family unit around Liverpool. It was incredibly interesting because we can see from the literature that people learn and respect environments more when they are very well structured, strict, but loving. Those people end up being the most complete, as we can say, and complete basically means satisfied in life, content, self-motivated, self-regulating, and many other things. So what I'm trying to get at by these things is, yes, it's always been there in football, but we're losing it. And we've been losing it for about the last 20 years, I think. If you look at the managers who were in the 80s and 90s, they always had a touch of psychology about them. A minder's touch was the phrase back in the day, which basically meant I can get him under my wing or in the palm of my hand, getting him to peak mental performance, but at the same time playing football. Whether that means something such as the Bobby Robson approach, you know, where we bring in staff who can support the lads, but at the same time we're strict but loving, you know. How was Bobby Robson in 1990 able to get the most out of Paul Gascoigne? But arguably throughout his club career, he was so unstable in his different environments that perhaps he never reached the peaks that he should have. Even though he was an incredible player and probably one of the best two in the world at one point between him and Baggio. I think that it's always been there, but we've lost those soft skills. The roles defined differently in different countries. So in Denmark, they might call me a mental coach, for example, although the specifications there don't include any sort of football. In the US, more specific, again, cognitive coach, although once again, it's very specific, not necessarily related to the actual game in such. You see a lot of sports psychologists floating from sport to sport, and it's not my position to comment on anyone else. I work with incredible sports psychologists. I work in a team of people who really know what they're doing, but I'm very much a believer that me knowing football, me being involved in football, having my UEFA, having my Spanish Pro, it gives me a huge advantage. I think each country has an interpretation of the role, the act defined by different actions. 80s and 90s, perhaps it would have been described as an assistant coach. But now we see many assistant coaches who are essentially the coach, and the manager is now the more or less father figure of the team. So the roles have reversed a little bit, which, you know, is fine. It's another way of doing it. character and personality was often talked about in the past, in the 80s, the 90s, but now you're more likely to have a conversation about technique or dual success. So we can see the emphasis has completely shifted. Ability to see tight psychological aspects and technical and tactical at the same time is incredibly useful, because when I'm looking at a game, I'm looking with both eyes. So in so much as that I'm looking at, yes, how have they received it? Is it a closed control? Is it an open control? But then I'm looking, how are they interpreting the space between them and their opponent? Are they doing that because they're scared that the opponent is faster than them? Are they doing that because they're low in confidence? Or are they doing that to try and attract the opponent to then skip past them? Well, I can do that at the same time. Whilst a classically trained coach might not have that specific eye on the actions why a person does what they do. So if the coach then shouts something, that the player might be looking at them saying, what do you know why I'm trying to do what I'm doing? The classic role of a sports psychologist: help athletes cope with pressure, play resilience, improve self-motivation, manage self-talk, reintroduction after injury. My role, I would say, is more cognitive periodization, managing arousal, over-under-stimulation and training, the ability to see that. Is that player trying to work out what to do? And then if we give them more instruction, are we going to burn them out? We call it tactical fatigue and so on. Throughout the conversation, I'll try and use clear, not intelligent language, because it does annoy me when people use phrases that are not in the mainstream. I'm very much a believer in Einstein's idea of you make an idea as simple as possible, and that's how you get it across. Not that you use big words and try and come off as intelligent. And that's one of the other reasons why I work the way I do, is because I try to communicate those things with people. I try to connect with people. And then through that, you create small teams of culture. And then through that, cultural leaders are born, and you try and manage it that way. It's a very hybridized job, I will be honest.
Yeah, there's so much for us to dig into there, and I think we'll spend the rest of our time teasing out some of the things you've just said in that answer. But before we do, just interested to hear your thoughts then on, do you think that it is impossible for any coach to succeed within the world of football without having some of those soft skills that you've talked about?
Well, that's an interesting question, because you're essentially asking me, is it possible to be a robot and then succeed at football? And I think the answer is no, because within football, we see that the teams that go on to become dynasties are essentially well-run structures in which strong connections are formed. There is no coincidence that Carlo Ancelotti, wherever he goes, despite many people making criticisms of his or Zidane's tactical knowledge, have the ability to connect with their players and get them to peak mental performance. And then if you look at, for example, places whereby we just buy players in, we just bring players in, the amount of times that's worked, I honestly don't think it does. I think you're going to be much more successful bringing in the person with the right mental attributes to suit your team than someone else who's got a 2% increase in dual succession or crossing completion.
Yeah, it's interesting, because I guess I would even maybe flip that on its head, because I think, yes, you mentioned Carlo Ancelotti, you mentioned Zidane. These are managers who, as you say, some people might, you know, denigrate their tactical acumen. But at the same time, I guess the same thing happens the other way for managers who are smart tactically, right? Like Pep Guardiola. People can sometimes fall into the trap of saying, well, he is a bit too robotic. He does just care about the tactical aspects. But clearly, Pep has the ability to psychologically motivate his players as well, right?
Clearly, yes. If you look at the way he talks about John Stones and Rodri, I know, because I've worked in these environments, I've worked with these players. These players will run through walls for him because of the way he talks to them. And the Guardiola you see will not be the Guardiola that is with them every day, because he knows more than anyone else. He was a footballer. If you sit down at lunch and you lean across the table and you go, when the eight presses, fall back, and then John, you're going to move, the heads are going to be burnt out. He will have a switch in which he goes from being one figure to another. in which we go from being a casual environment to a working environment. And that's why he is able to get the players to run through walls for him, is because he manages that very well. And if you hear the way he talks about his players, it's incredible.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
A phrase that you used in your previous answer was cognitive periodization, which I think is really interesting. This is the idea that you want to keep players at peak mental performance throughout the whole spread of the season, right? Let's talk about that a little bit, because obviously cognitive periodization is following on from this idea of tactical periodization that has become the go-to way for coaches to work in terms of how they actually get their players to perform on the pitch from a tactical point of view. Can you tell us a little bit, just for the listeners who might not have heard of what tactical periodization is, what that is, just so we can then move on to talking about how that might function in a more cognitive sense?
Yeah, well, just to set the idea up, while periodization has been used in coaching for some time, cognitive periodization has not been explored in general. In fact, very rarely mentioned in football. It's not something that's spoken about. While tactical ideas are important, cognitive periodization focuses on the cognitive effort through practice and how that's interiorized by the players, how they take it on. Organizing the player's cognitive load, and I'll talk about the cognitive load soon, by learning and specialities, and implementing it in a periodic manner during training has a great ability to develop players' cognitive skills and therefore improve their decision-making. When people talk about tactical periodization, they're talking about something that was popularized by Jose Mourinho and the Portuguese gang around the year 2006. The idea focuses on specific elements within football or a micro level. Tactical periodization focuses on the following principles. We've got specificity. We've got making principles operational. We've got systematic repetition, complex progression. We've got performance stabilization, hierarchy organization, and the last one, which is the one we're going to talk about, the tactical fatigue and concentration. All these are based around the game model and the physical load mainly. However, cognitive periodization is creating repeatable and usable structures born from both neuroscience and psychology in order to maximize the cognitive potential of a player. Each player will have a cognitive potential. You will have a cognitive potential, John, when we go and play darts, and I will have a cognitive potential. That will decrease rapidly depending on how many pints we have. The current model tactical is based on tactical fatigue and concentration, which includes emotional load, preference of muscular contractions, which is one that's a bit bizarre, but it's in there, a complexity of principles, number of players, space size, predominant actions, length of time, and level of intimacy. Right, that's an idea of what the tactical periodization, but it doesn't nail into the core issues that the vast majority of psychological issues are either observed by a clinical psychologist, whose knowledge in football is extremely limited, or a coach, right, whose psychological idea is quite limited. So when people are looking at players through that lens of tactical periodization, they're missing quite a lot of things that would be incredibly important in the development of the player. There's a lot of ideas, but it's about creating a model in which you can observe the players and have a very good idea of where you want to go. the current structure that is used to analyze the cognitive load, potential intentions, and intentions within football is extremely limited. It's extremely limited. It shows awareness of certain aspects. However, it's not very complete. It's not very complete. So that's an idea of the tactical. And then if I may, John, is it okay to go on to the cognitive load?
Well, let's just break things down, because there's a lot in there. So tactical periodization is the way that coaches are going to slowly introduce tactical ideas across the course of a season to their players, in order to, as you say, get the most out of that process. You don't want to load everything at the beginning of the season, so they're thinking everything, because as you said, that can result in fatigue. And so the process then is about how do we spread this out through the course of the season in order to get the maximum output from our tactical training. And I suspect that what you're going to talk to us about now with the cognitive aspect is how do we do that, but from a cognitive point of view? How do we get it so that the players are going into training each day fresh to be able to learn, fresh to be able to play in on match days, so that you're going to get the best out of them from a psychological point of view as well as from a tactical point of view? Is that correct?
100%. So if you can imagine it, we'll break it down really simple. If you can imagine John, at the weekend you have a tournament with Rubik's Cubes, right? Really simple. You have a tournament, and we'll take out all of the physical aspects to begin with. We'll take out stresses and variables. You have a tournament of Rubik's Cubes. I don't know what they're called, but you can imagine. And I say to you, right, okay, John, what we're going to do is on Monday you're going to do, say, 70% training. On Wednesday you're going to do 100%, on Friday you're going to do 20%, and then on Saturday you're going to do 100 and blah blah percent, right? Just as an idea. You would probably say to me, well, why on Friday am I doing less than on Wednesday? What is that journey happening? Why would I not incline? Why would I not create a situation whereby each day within the week I am building the previous knowledge to the point where I'm not overwhelmed and I feel like I can be in a mental situation to know all of the information that you've gave me so far, accumulate the knowledge. However, that's not really how it works in modern day football. A lot of the time what happens is we see that coaches have the most cognitive load, and I'll describe what cognitive load is, on the Wednesday. That means the most stimuli that the players have. And then come the Friday or the Thursday, in football they call it a minus one match day, in which you're one day before, people like give them funny names to things. Basically, the players go through analytical drills very slowly on a big pitch, right? In which they are involved in less scanning, less picture building, working memory, less inhibition control, the ability to see whether the pass is on or the pass isn't on, control that and play backwards, and many other aspects that are happening. So come match day, that's a big jump to make, right? You're going from 50, 80, 20, and then you're going 100. So it doesn't make any sense, but that's how the majority of football is formed, and that's due to the fact that a lot of football's been formed around the idea of sports sciences that built up throughout the 90s and then the noughties. I apologize for the expression, not one I like. So what's happened there is we've built that around sports science. But at no point, apart from this conversation we're having, John, which is extremely surprising, at no point has anyone banged the fist on the table and went, whoa, 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 whoa. How do we get them in peak mental performance for the big game come the weekend? Because are they sitting on the bum all Friday? Probably isn't the best idea.
So what does that look like practically then?
Yeah, okay. So practically we would look at, we can agree that, for example, a 3-3 plus one, the plus one being a joker, or they say a comedian in Spain, is more cognitively challenged than free kicks. But however, what happens is that on a Friday before the game, you will see quite regularly teams practicing free kicks. Okay. You will also see teams, as I mentioned pitch size earlier on, what they will tend to do is they will tend to play on a big pitch. Right? and then they will tend to talk about the opponent a lot on the Friday. So what's happened is they've waited to the end of the week and they've gave the team all of the information. They've primed the team. What it looks like practically is loading your players cognitively in a way whereby throughout the week, those instructions about the opposite team can be pushed in seamlessly to the training without any tactical fatigue, overload on the brain, overload of information, so that the players can form that together and take ownership of that together. So that your centre back, when your six runs out on the Friday, it's not something that's surprising because we've been practicing that all week. A lot of the time, what happens is that if the cognitive load's too level, if the cognitive load is too low, the players won't reach the desired outcome of understanding how they can tactically adapt and be tactically flexible, which is why Spain is so ahead of many other countries. Because when you watch training sessions in Spain, what you will see is time and time again, coaches talking to players. And maybe there'll be eight coaches talking to players. And what the players are able to do after years of this is they're able to have a full-flown conversation, scan the play, read the pass, and adapt at the same time. So this means that Spanish players are able to do four or five systems at the same time. Whilst if you watch other teams, they're very, very limited in what cognitive load they can take on. So it's creating an inclination in information. It's feeding it in at the right time throughout the training. It's making the trainings really relative to the games that you're going to be in. So reducing a situation from a full-size pitch into a very small environment. Well, if you want the physical load to be less because you're worried about the game on the weekend, then the idea is that we make it into a very small space. The players don't have to run much, but they're practicing exactly the same scanning and the same movements as they will on the weekend. The argument is always that, yeah, but on a bigger pitch, they're able to practice it more. There's no evidence of that. The evidence shows us that by practicing that throughout the week and weaving it into our training, we're able to reach a much more elevated peak mental state.
So cognitive periodization then is just the process of making sure that your players are in the best mental condition going into match day to be able to deal with things on the pitch.
100%. But it's not to be confused with things like confidence or self-discipline. Because often when I talk about psychology, I had a conversation recently with some coaches and I described I'm a coach, sports psychologist, and the emphasis was on psychology immediately. And I think there's a big disconnect in football to understand that you're working with people. You're working with people and I can see the tactical periodization. I can see the four phases of the game, but at the same time, I'm thinking, have we prepared our winger against this big lump of a centre half and how he's going to overcome that because it's a completely different challenge?
You say in your LinkedIn profile, I'm a strong believer that cognitive stresses stimulate growth in training in order for players to vastly outgrow any preset sociological limitations. And I think this is what you're touching on here, right? You're saying that because there's been a lack in this approach, not thinking through how to develop players cognitively for these sorts of the sorts of hurdles they have to overcome as players, what we're seeing is players aren't actually being able to develop. Not just in terms of where they are at cognitively, but also in terms of the ceilings that they could potentially have given all of the other factors that surround them as well. Is that correct?
That is exactly it. That's exactly it. They're not prepared. We've entered a society. We are now in a society in which people are not encouraged to come out of the bubbles that they live in. They're not encouraged to work hard. They're not encouraged to get their head down. And that's for many different elements that probably isn't for a TIFO conversation. However, what we want to do is we want to give the players the environment in which they will practice as real as possible situations. So I'm a huge believer in players can learn, learn, and learn again. So the key is giving them the stepping stones to improve whilst balancing that with training as 17 other players. That's really difficult for a coach. You have 17 other players, yet you have to remember that Pablo or John, in this instance, he is often turning to the right because in a previous game, the ball was stolen on the left. And what we need to do is we need to move him away from that automation. So that's where I would come in. How does a coach create that training session with the specificity at the same time regarding a player's strengths and weaknesses, but not overwhelm the players or overwhelm themselves? Spain taught me so much regarding this. The individual objectives must be challenged in the exercise that the coach chooses. The exercises must take into consideration the styles that the club is going on, but also the trajectory of the player. So a good example of that is Lewis Dunk at Brighton. Before Potter was at Brighton, he was considered a no-nonsense centre-back, perhaps. So if I'd have asked someone at that time what style of manager could he play for, maybe Roy Hodgson would have been bandied about or someone like this. But we've seen that a player who was not extremely young was able to develop himself under the right stimuli. So we've seen a player effectively at Brighton go from being worth X to worth more than X to his team and both in the transfer market. We see now with Klopp how if you give the right stimuli to young players such as Curtis Jones, they will transform from a marauding number 10 to a pressing monster who love to press. How do you do that in training? And that's where I'm at. How do you create those personalities? Because it's personality creation at the end of the day. And that happens through culture. That happens through the culture you create. So if you have someone, and the listeners can't see me, but I have a big ginger beard and a terrible set of hair. If you have me on the sidelines concentrated on those things, or someone of my ilk, it's much more likely to get better because someone is helping that person move towards those objectives and guiding them towards that adventure. I think it's really, really important to focus on those things. And I think it's an untapped goldmine within football that we don't talk about these things more often in a very practical, usable and repeatable manner.
Mm. It sounds to me like you're saying that we need to make training difficult, but not so difficult that players get overwhelmed with it, right? So what are some of the ways that you are able to achieve that in your own coaching?
Yeah, so one of the ways that I would always encourage that to be achieved is that we work, in Spanish clubs, they work in very small pitches, but they work in very real environments. So whereby the coaches are incredibly efficient at creating game-like environments in training where the players are constantly challenged. To the extent where if a coach stops things repeatedly, people get annoyed. People get annoyed, John, because people are like, they need to play to improve what you're telling them to play. If you stop things constantly, they're not going to improve. So I think competitive, high-intensity, high-standard environments are incredibly important. I think putting the players in environments where they're going to be challenged more than they would in the pitch is also important. So we've seen a classic example of training might be something like a 3-3+1. And then an evolution of that might be a 3-1+1. So that means that you have a defensive joker and an attacking joker. And they have different colours. So now as a player, I'm scanning for not just two colours, three. I'm scanning four different colours and I have to make a decision in that. So that means that what you've done is you notch that up another level whereby the players are looking for four different colours at once and that puts an incredible stress on the brain. So as you can imagine, come the weekend when I have two colours in front of me, well, no, that's not true. You have three colours in front of you. The referee is also a colour and you don't want to pass him the ball or her in that case. Something often overlooked in football. So that player is ready for those environments. The same thing would be said at a corner, for example. I'm a huge believer in organizational psychology and set pieces within football. I think who's communicating with the bench, but who's activating the players and who's organizing the players. And all those three things are different. Normally you'll have a goalkeeper who's activating the players, getting them in the right profiles in order to receive the ball. Then you'll have a player who's, and they just do this naturally. But of course the best do it naturally and the rest forget. Then you've got another player organising the players. You're a little bit in front. You need to go there. Are we in the right line? Have we adjusted for so going on? And then another player who needs to communicate with the bench in order to say what's happening and what are they adapting? Because I guarantee that every team now will have a set piece analysis who's looking and saying this has changed and this has changed and this has changed. But I'm able to create those structures and do that within training so the players normalize those things. And then what do you know it all of a sudden? You have John in training who suddenly stepped into the role of what he believes, has practiced it a lot, and then becomes a top communicator. And everyone says, this kid's a leader. And it's like, no, you don't understand. He's not a leader. We enabled him to become that. And then he did, which is amazing. He or she, apologies.
Yeah, and that's something that I think I've seen a few pieces about Jordan Henderson at Liverpool being bandied around on the internet this week, talking about just that aspect, that not only is he in the team in order to be a performer as one of the individuals, but also the players look to him in order to have those tactical instructions as they're going, which is, you know, a lot of people think, well, that's the job of the coach, right? But it's so much easier to have someone on the pitch who is able to direct things as they go, right?
Exactly. I can't remember a team in history who've won a lot who have not had leaders on the pitch, what we would call leaders. If we go from the Contes at Juventus, never considered an incredible player, but was a leader without a doubt on the pitch, the Roy Keanes, the Jordan Hendersons, a very different leader, of course, the Patrick Vieiras. We can go through it again and again and again. But these people weren't born speaking at corners. They didn't come out the womb and suddenly start saying, you need to move back 5 yards. They did that because they were put in environments in which they progressed as people and players. And what essentially happened with someone like Jordan Henderson becoming a club captain for his hometown club at 20 years of age, well, that has a profound effect on a person. That has a profound effect on how they behave. And I always think about those things in relation to football being incredibly important.
Another aspect of this as well that you've touched on when we've been prepping for this episode is that the ability to be able to go through this cognitive periodization could actually prepare players to make steps up to higher level, perceived higher level leagues. So could you talk us a little bit through that kind of concept as well?
Yeah, I think that what happens is that, so if we look at the clubs in the higher echelons, and then we look at clubs, maybe what you would deem a step down from that, although I'm not really into the whole ranking of clubs. I think we can move past that as people in football. What you tend to see is you tend to see that the top clubs struggle to produce talent. They struggle to produce talent. They struggle to move talent through. And I think a lot of the time what happens is that players believe that they've made it. Players believe that they're the big time. They are going to make it to the top, whether that might be a Raval Morrison, a Paul Pogba, and then maybe to some extent a player like Tarat, who had incredible potential but never realised that potential. And we're talking about Paul Pogba, a World Cup winner here. But of course, at club level, it could be argued that he was an incredible player, but he never really did it consistently. I think the big problem is that we live in a society where players are given a lot very, very young. They don't need to. A lot of them are given a lot of responsibility very young. A lot of them are given or become the fulcrum of the team too young. And as a result, we see a lot of players not making that jump. At the same time as that, we also see a lot of players who stagnate. They stagnate at a certain age and they don't develop into different types of players. The perfect idea of that would be someone like James Milner, who's developed throughout the years of being a completely different player. And now he's playing for De Zerbi very well. as an inverted fullback, coming into the midfield and dictating the tempo, dictating the rhythm. That happens because those people are given the stimuli to do that. And I think if clubs want to produce top players, because I believe that my position is ideal between the first team and the under-18s, for example, if those clubs want to produce those top players, they need to produce a mental trajectory for those players. There was a saying when Iniesta went to Barcelona. So he comes to La Masia and he arrives and they said, just look after him. Don't change anything about him. Because technically they knew he had the ability to reach the top. If he just maintained his trajectory, if he just maintained what he was doing, he was going to make it to the top. So the question is, if a player is the top of their band at under 12, under 14, and then they don't go on to play at a very high level, there's alarm bells that should be ringing because something has went wrong. Because they've been practicing the same, they've been improving their technique the same. So it's just a mental, it's something happening mentally that's going on. And I think that's really, really important to focus on, especially if clubs want to breed players, essentially.
Let's talk a little bit about communication, because that's another aspect that I've picked up from you in terms of what you consider your role to be. And obviously, communication is an important aspect of football. I don't think anyone would disagree with that as a sort of blanket statement. But I think what I've picked up from talking to you is that it's not just about being able to communicate. It's about being able to communicate in the right way, in the right environment, and generating environments where players in particular are able to communicate functionally on a pitch. And that, again, adds value because you're getting more out of those players. Yes, you're not necessarily changing their intrinsic physical attributes, but you're actually able to bring those out more because the context is so important and the communication allows them to perform to a higher level. So yeah, let's talk a little bit about communication. What is it that you want to see from players on the pitch in terms of communication?
So the first thing is responsibility for what's happening, and that can look many different ways, but a good example would be the centre backs have the ball, they decide when to pass it into midfield. They can see everything that's happening in front of them. And what we see is that we see things like in Barcelona, they always say we communicate with the ball as much as we do with our mouths. So whether the ball is played in on a certain profile to the players to let the players know they need to turn, or whether the ball is played in directly square in the middle of the feet to say, give it back to me. So that's a signal within that. That's a type of communication. So it's not just mouth, it's also with how you're playing. However, by the centre-back having to, as a constraint within training, say to his teammate, turn or play back. Now that depends on the language, of course. We would say gira or de cara. De cara means back to face. By him taking on that responsibility, him or her, and as a centre-back taking on that responsibility, you force them to scan the game at the same time. You force them to be tactically aware of what's happening. So when I've got the ball, if I'm playing it into my central midfielder, just as we've seen at the weekend, Chelsea versus Liverpool, when Virgil van Dijk was very happy to play the ball into an 18-year-old, I wasn't on pitch, but I guarantee you he was telling the 18-year-old, turn or give me it back. Turn or give me it back. And by doing that, you relieve all of the pressure. You remove the errors. You remove the likelihood of losing the ball in that situation. Because as a centre-back, I know that he's scanning over me. So it produces clear, fluid style in which everybody can do their job well. The other thing is it enhances team cohesion. It improves strategy execution. Facilitates feedback as well. When the coaches, how many times I've seen coaches in the world communicate with players and nothing come back? That's not what you want. You want an atmosphere in which everybody's communicating and people are able to take on board your saying. You do not know if they're taking it on board unless you get some sort of response. It increases adaptability, enhances decision making. Communication, for me, is an absolute fundamental of football that we are missing. We are breeding now people who communicate less and less every day because of social media. People do not talk to each other the way they used to. I intentionally smile at people on a day-to-day basis because I don't want to be any part of that. I say, how are you? I love that culture. I love the, how are you? How's the family? How's this? And that's how I approach training as well. I think that communication is quite frankly another part of that cognitive periodization that is the fact that teams aren't taking it on and employing someone almost specifically for that, it's detrimental.
One of the interesting things about this is that I think that we can often fall into the trap of taking individual personalities into account when we think about how we should be approaching players, not just in terms of communication, but also in terms of just general psychology, right? So talking there about you want your centre back to be doing that scanning, to be doing that communication with the central midfielder. I think in the past, in teams that I've played in, there's always been this understanding, oh, X, Y, or Z is a quiet player. They're not going to be vociferous on the pitch. And so we rely on the people who are to be able to do that. To what extent do you think that holds teams back, this assumption that we actually should be individually setting our approach to training in order to emphasize the personalities of players? Because it sounds a little bit to me like you're, again, wanting players to be out of their comfort zone and say, okay, maybe you are naturally a quite quiet person, but in this instance, you need to step out of that comfort zone and become someone who can communicate.
That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm saying this is a standard for the team. This is a standard for what we do here. An example might be a player playing for a very famous academy where they play very short passes and they keep the ball as much as possible in order to attract the opponent to leave spaces over the other side of the pitch. Say no names. I can absolutely guarantee you, if we go down the same route of analysing personalities by people who do not analyse personalities or have not had training in analysing personalities, may I say, then that player, oh, he's a bit timid, so we'll let him pass the ball sooner. No. If you want something in life, you have to face challenges. And I work with players, I know players who do not like talking on the pitch. They do not like jumping and saying their name, which is one of the first stages of development in communication and one of the first stages of development in personality creation. Jumping, saying your name, taking responsibility for that. Players don't like doing it sometimes because they know if they miss the header, then everyone's going to go, ooh, Juan missed the header there. But that's by the by. Because if you want a team that takes responsibility for their actions, is stable in regulation when the other team scores a goal, produces consistency, then those things need to be overcome. We have a centre midfielder and he always plays it backwards. Well, okay, why is he playing it backwards? Because we want to do this and we want this style. And to be honest with you, John, I think that a lot of coaches hide behind that because they don't really know how to interact with it. They don't know how to create those personalities. And as a result, they just say, oh, well, he's a quiet lad, isn't he?
So how do you then implement ideas about individual personalities into training? Like, how do you account for that? Even if you want to have that one size fits all, this is what you were expected if you're on this team. How do you then cater for different personalities? Is it a case of creating a unified personality? I presume you would say no. So I'm interested to hear how you would balance off the individual with the collective in that sense.
It's a great question, but I would always separate standards within the team to personalities. Mm-hmm. You go to work, John, and I imagine that you have to be in at a set time. I imagine that you have to clear your desk occasionally because you've got McVitie's biscuits all over the place. I know I have. I'm looking down at my belly right now. The fact of the matter is that those things are standards. When we create standards and when we are strict with those standards, we see people standing up to them and becoming them. We see them say, right, that's what's needed here. I'm going to do that. When you start relaxing standards, that's a different kettle of fish. So my argument would be almost, why would you relax a standard because a player has a different personality? Surely that's a terrible sign to everybody else in the team. The classic Roy Keane line of, that's what you pay me to do. Well, he's right. He's right. You pay me to run as a midfielder. So if I'm not running, which is the basic core of football, we've got a big problem here. And it's like in training, you hear many stories of Wayne Rooney going from Everton to Manchester United at that time. And he said the standards were just different in training. It's the same thing. It's the same thing. And I would implement those standards throughout the whole of training. Because when it comes to a cup final, if your player does not have the ability, in the case of an error, to shout, mine, and just clear the ball, because there's been a huge error being done. There's been a huge error being committed. Well, all of that work previously is completely forgot about. So I think to be honest, I don't mind personalities. I work with people who make jokes all the time. I work with people who, at any given moment, will put the ball, nutmeg me, put the ball between my legs. And I work with people who are very, very serious. And, you know, I put my arm around them and I give them a little whisper in the ear. I give them a joke, an insult, and we laugh together. I don't mind personalities, but there will always be standards that we need to adhere to.
I just want to close out by talking a little bit more generally about this hybrid position that you have working as a coach / psychologist. You've mentioned a lot and it sounds as though the fact that you're working in Spain has a huge impact in your ability to be able to do the job that you do. Do you think that what you do simply isn't being done in the UK, for example? And do you see that changing anytime soon?
I think that my set of skills are quite rare, and I've engineered that. I wasn't born like that. It's not some sort of superiority thing. My set of skills are quite rare. So that's one thing that plays into it. I mean, the other thing is that football in general is around 20 years behind the rest of the world. We see the NFL with much more specificity much sooner. We see sports psychologists being brought in American sports much sooner. We see progressive ideas in football coming in much later than they should, much, much later. VR, for example, is now a new development in football, whilst it's been used in other elements of the world for a long time. I think the point is there needs to be someone within a club who, for whatever reason, listens to something like this and goes, that's fantastic. But that's not as common as you would think. It's not as common that someone would listen to this and then as a result think, that's an extra 0.5% we hadn't considered. Football is very slow moving. People within football, unfortunately, are quite ego driven. Unfortunately, are quite protective of what they've got. They try to hide what's going on inside their clubs. I think it's more a matter of football's lacking of evolution than anything else. Because, of course, after this conversation, maybe one person will listen to this and think, wow, I could do that. And they could. Of course they could. And then as a result, there's two people doing it or three people doing it. So I think that hopefully by having this conversation, this will spread the message about, well, this is another possibility. You have people who are analyst coaches. So why can't we have overlaps in other areas? What's stopping us?
Chris, I could talk to you for another hour on this topic. It's been hugely illuminating to me and I really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for coming on. If our listeners want to see what you're putting out or get in touch with you, I've got your Twitter down here as Chris O'Hare 26. Now you spell Chris with a K, so K-R-I-S, and then O'Hare 26. That's your Twitter handle. And then you have LinkedIn as well. Is there any other way that people could get in touch with you if they need to?
No, those two are the primary ways. I just want to say thank you very much, John, for having this conversation. I have listened to TIFO for a very long time. I am a huge fan of your work, and I think that the fact that you're even willing to have this conversation when most people hear what I do and can't quite compute it is testament to yourself. So thank you very much for that.
No, thank you. The thanks should all be yours. But thank you again for coming on today.